On This Week in Enterprise Tech, AT&T and HP Enterprise are throwing in the towel. The EU might have a way to hold companies accountable for bad security practices. And F5 Networks is here for a deep dive into single sign-on. Follow the BAM. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 264, recorded November 3rd, 2017. Visibility, Management, and SSO with F5 Networks. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big world. I'm going to need a little help from my friend, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, and he's all hotspotty today. Brian, what's up with this?
Well, I've got my new Verizon Jetpack that I'm actually getting 100 meg symmetrical in certain places in Honolulu. Very cool. And then this is a cellular modem that we're going to be using for a research project. Notice the external antenna. So we're going to be able to go put some high-gain antennas and even get connectivity in weird places.
Now, you were saying you're going to be censoring the entire Alawai, so this is going to be the internet of streams, I guess?
Yeah, there you go.
Go figure. Okay, well, it's not only the Alawai crazy Brian Chi that we've got on. We've got my good friend Lou Maresca. You may remember him from things like Coding 101, from the early days of TWiT, and of course, from the Booth Babe at Microsoft Ignite. Lou, you're home today. Why did Microsoft send you home?
You know, this whole area tends to close down when it snows, and so it's snowing today, and so we're doing some work from home.
Wait, it's snowing in Seattle? Wait, what?
It is. The site's pretty much closed down. It's pretty funny.
Okay, that's just crazy, because it was 103 degrees last week in the Bay Area. I'm not even going to try to figure that one out. Instead, folks, we're just going to say we've got a great show. Not only are we going to be doing the blips and the bytes, we're going to be diving into the world of enterprise technology, but we've got a special guest from F5 Networks. If you want to know what's the best way to custom tailor your solutions, you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first, let's jump into the blips. Now, back in August, we covered the Louisville Google Fiber case, in which U.S. District Court Judge David Hale ruled that AT&T was using the court system as a delaying tactic to keep Google Fiber from deploying a competing broadband network. Now, the decision came after AT&T sued Louisville and Jefferson County over the one-touch provision that had been voted into law 2 weeks prior. The one-touch provision allows a carrier to negotiate once with an incumbent for access to all utility poles along the deployment route instead of haggling for each and every one, a process that would add years, if not decades, to the deployment timeline. AT&T argued that Louisville lacked the authority to regulate pole attachment, to which the judge quoted the charter of the Kentucky State Public Commission that specifically gave Louisville the power to do exactly that. At the time of our broadcast, AT&T reps were quoted as saying that they disagreed with the decision and that they were weighing their options. Well, it seems that they finished their weighing and decided that they've lost. AT&T has announced that it will not contest the judgment, instead releasing a PR statement stating that they have always been very concerned about the choice of consumers, and they believe that their 1 gigabit per second broadband option, which only came into existence because Google offered 1 gigabit per second connectivity, is clearly the consumer choice for broadband. Still, it might be too late for AT&T to salvage this stalling tactic. Other municipalities across the nation have watched the Louisville case and are now planning their own one-touch regulation. Nashville, which is facing almost the exact same lawsuit by AT&T, now has legal precedent to rely on. In other words, the day of broadband reckoning may be approaching.
So nanofiber meshes, or aka electrospinning, is a very versatile method of producing applications for water filters, tissue development, and possibly solar energy cells. Why haven't it been widely used yet? Well, because they're hard to produce and manufacture. You need special conditions such as an airlocked clean room in order to fabricate accurate meshes, making it a bit impractical for everyday use. A new 3D printing device developed by researchers at MIT is about to take nanofiber mesh creation simpler, create it more cheaper, and actually more accurate. The tiny microfluidic device consists of an array of small nozzles through which a fluid mixture containing a polymer particles can pass. The nozzles are arranged into two rows, slightly offset from one another, which enables the fabrication of line nanofibers. The MIT researchers used a $3,500 Solus DLP 3D printer made by Raify 3D to fabricate their device. Devices like solar cells can benefit from nanofibers because of their high ratio of surface area to volume. So soak materials that need to be permeable only at the small scales, like water filters, and so can lightweight and strong materials like body armor. Researchers are continuing to develop the technology and feel it can be deterministically engineer a fiber network, then it will unlock a tremendous amount of innovation.
Well, we have an extreme turnaround in the acquisition of Brocade. Brocade has long been known for ultra-low latency high-speed switches that have been the backbone of high-performance computing and storage area networks. Extreme Networks was once the purple giant with custom silicon that put giants like Cisco on notice that customers wanted more in their enterprise switching systems. Padre and I experienced this firsthand as Extreme Networks did some of the first switch-based routing on huge address spaces like the InteropNet Class A network, and then one of the original players pushing the routing out to the edge. What this surprise acquisition does is complement their previous purchases to bring them arguably into the number three position for enterprise infrastructure by adding the top-of-the-rack data center switching capability. Only time will tell if this turnaround will keep them growing their market share, but they are certainly the purple people eater.
2016 and 2017 have been particularly difficult years for HP Enterprise and Dell EMC in the commodity data center market. The low-cost, low-margin servers that line the racks of data centers have always been a competitive market, but when selling to Tier 1 enterprises like Facebook, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, the margins are squeezed even more as in-house IT takes away all but the stickiest of value adds. Add to that the flood of unbranded white boxes from Chinese vendors, and the task has become all but impossible. Enough so that HP Enterprise has officially thrown in the towel. Last week at the HPE Analyst Day, President Antonio Neri announced that HP Enterprise would no longer sell low-end server hardware to top-tier customers. The move might be a surprise to some, since HPE held a respectable 11.5% share of cloud infrastructure servers. But white box manufacturers like Supermicro and Quanta are happy with single-digit margins, while HPE is not. This is a logical step in HPE's movement towards retiring low-profit, high-maintenance product lines, instead focusing on their high-end, top-of-rack gear.
So right before the holiday shopping season, Amazon thought it would be a good idea to release a new feature that would put another nail in the brick-and-mortar coffin. Amazon was introduced to the new AR View, which lets customers visualize their products before they buy it in their own living space using a smartphone camera. The first release of this is for iOS devices, and it offers the ability to view thousands of products from the home or office, including furniture, electronics, toys, games, home decor, and more, in augmented reality. There have been some retailers like Target and Wayfair and IKEA that have dabbed in this little bit of approach and mainly surrounding furniture and painting applications, but Amazon wants to take it a step further. They know that some purchases are driven by aesthetics, and they want to bridge the gap that not even brick and mortar stores can even do. The AR View feature takes advantage of Apple's AR Kit, which allows third-party developers to more easily add AR functionality to their mobile apps. As the shopping season arrives, we'll soon see if AR can finish the need to leave your home for gift shopping.
This story comes from folks at NordVPN. On Wednesday, a new law coming into effect in Russia will bring tighter control over which websites Russians can access, enabling the government to block the sites of undesirable organizations without a court order. VPNs, which allow bypassing internet restrictions, will be required to block the websites that are on the Russian government's list. Quote, "This law is being passed before the presidential election, which will take place in March, and we believe that it is targeting opposition websites, blogs, and journalists. Journalists are used to be able to communicate anonymously in order to avoid repercussions for expressing their voices will now be affected and potentially put in danger. NordVPN has a goal to provide unrestricted access to the internet to people around the world, and we hope to continue functioning in Russia just as we did before," says Marty P. Camden, CMO of NordVPN. "We stand for the freedom of speech, and our service helps activists stay safe and, you know, ensure their privacy and security, blah, blah, blah. Life is good." Well, the new law is part of a wide-ranging communications crackdown. For example, the messaging app Telegram was fined in October for failing to register and provide user information to a word, a Roscoe Commandant, I can never pronounce Russian, the communications watchdog. Russia has also announced that it will block Facebook next year if it doesn't agree to store personal data of Russian users on Russian servers.
If you're an IT guy, you fix problems. It's what you do. And when a 20-year-old printer goes on the fritz, you probably just replace it. But what happens when the printer in question is located at a remote teleworking office in space? That's the challenge that faced Stephen Hunter, manager of computer resources for the International Space Station. The ISS has been using Epson 800 inkjet printers for the past two decades. It's how they print about 1,000 pages a month to have hard copy of mission information, emergency procedures, and even photos from home. But as with any technology, the printers wore out and were replaced by newer Epson 800s until they ran out of parts. So they turned to Hunter, who turned to HP. He gave them a specific list of requirements, including the ability to print and handle paper in zero G, super low power requirements, 100% waste handling, and something that won't cause a fire in space. Laser printers were out. Not only do they use far more power than permissible, but flammable toner dust in zero G is a disaster waiting to happen. So HP took one of their HP Envy 5600 inkjet printers and made a few modifications to fit the mission. First, they removed the scanning, faxing, and copying functions to drop weight and reduce power use. Then they replaced any gravity-assisted functions with mechanically-assisted analogs. Finally, HP built a new paper handling mechanism that would properly feed paper in zero-G. The end result is the Space Envy printer that is smaller, lighter, faster, and more power-efficient than the inkjet it's replacing. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites, and we've got a definite rantable doozy. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, you've probably heard the maxim location, location, location. And that's a shout out to the fact that it doesn't matter how good your idea, your portfolio, your performance might be if you're not in a place where people can actually find you. If you're art isn't in a good location, if your website isn't found at a good spot, if you don't own the right domain, well, just no one's going to find out how wonderful you are. Well, if only there were a place, a service, a company that understood location, location as it translates into the internet and would help you find that perfect location for your work, your portfolio, or your personal blog. Well, thankfully, there is. And it's called Hover. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Hover. What are you passionate about? Do you have an idea for business? Are you launching a creative project? Buying a domain name is the first and biggest step to building your brand online. Again, it's location, location, location. Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you brand yourself. That's a lot of choices to help you find the perfect domain name. If you're a blogger or a company trying to create new leads or, say, inform your customer base, you can use .blog instead of the generic .com or .biz domain names. Now, by using .blog, you're telling everyone to expect impactful content about your topic or business rather than a generic homepage. Or whatever your interest may be, Hover has an extension for you, be it .tech, .photo, or, say, .security. And do you know what else is great about Hover? The fact that they've got best-in-class customer support and no upsells. They don't make any commission from upsells. They just want to get you the service that you need, that you want. The Hover Connect feature allows you to connect your domain name to any host or website builder with just a few simple clicks. This is not one of those services that's going to try to lock you in to their services and their services alone. They want to give you the power of choice. That's really the promise of Hover. They've also got personalized email that matches your domain and further spreads and supports your online identity. Folks, if you understand that location is where it's at, if you have a project, a portfolio, a thing that you want to expose to the world, you owe it to yourself to try Hover. Show the online community who you are and what you're passionate about. Go to hover.com/twit and get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/twit. And we thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the show. Now, folks, we've talked a lot over the last couple of weeks, months, and years about breaches. And one of the things that you might have picked up is that things don't seem to be getting better. In fact, they seem to be getting worse, from Home Depot to Target to the OPM to Equifax. Well, what if there was a way, a pattern, something that we could do that might force companies, enterprises, to finally rethink their security ways? That's what this bite is going to be all about. Now, stop me if you've heard this before. Large corporation loses the sensitive data of millions of its customers. Said corporation delays telling their customers in order to buy time for their team to figure out what happened and to prepare damage control. Weeks, months, or years later, the company announced that they've been breached and offer a minimal compensation to the affected parties, maybe with a small fine, usually with nothing more than a tongue lashing by some government official who's going to use the exact same speech a few weeks or months down the road against another company. Now, if this sounds familiar, it's because it's the plot summary for most of the big breaches in the United States over the past 6 years. Again, from Target to Home Depot to Yahoo to Equifax, the only plot change on this off-rebooted bad movie is the number of records compromised and how poorly the company responds. We here on Twit have talked ad nauseum about how to make it stop. We've had guests on to talk about best practices and new technologies that could mitigate or even prevent breaches, but nothing seems to change. The next big breach is probably already underway, and it feels like there's nothing we can do about it. This past Tuesday, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman announced a $700,000 fine against Hilton Worldwide stemming from their loss of more than 350,000 credit cards in two separate breaches in 2015. The AG investigation found that not only did Hilton not have reasonable precautions in place to prevent the breaches, but that the response was woefully inadequate once they discovered the breach. Sound familiar? Specifically, once they knew of the breach, Hilton waited 9 months to notify affected customers. Now, on the one hand, this announcement, the $700,000 fine, is a good thing. It does hold a corporation accountable for bad practices that negatively affected its customers. However, in the larger picture, that's less than $2 per customer, or less than a penny a day for each customer that Hilton allowed to remain insecure and vulnerable while they decided how to time their announcement to least affect their corporate profits. Now, the problem is that while there are laws on the books to punish such actions, in the case of New York AG, it's the New York General Business Law, subsection 899. The penalties for those laws haven't really kept up with the sheer amount of sensitive data that can be compiled by a corporation in the digital world. Now, I'm going to go forward, but I do want to bring my host here, my co-host, in on this. Chibert, let's start with you. Again, this is a story that we hear time and time again. Check my perception, because it doesn't seem to be getting better. Every time we have one of these breaches, it seems like we're repeating the same script over and over. Have you noticed any of the response learning from the previous responses?
No. It's a broken record. For those of you that don't know what a record is, it spins around the sound. Yeah. Anyway.
Wow.
No, it's bad. It's really bad. We've been yakking about it. We've been trying to use shame on these companies. We've gotten to the point where a lot of people won't even use credit cards in Target on places like that. Yep. But they don't learn. Mm. We've asked the credit card companies to make changes. Haven't done anything.
Yeah. Well, we did have the conversation here, right? Remember?
Yeah. We had a crossover episode with Twill.
Yeah. So. It's kind of amazing that actually PS Chops in the chat room was kind of alluding to it. You know, until it hits their pocketbooks, it doesn't really matter. And a $700,000 fine for a company that makes billions is not even pocket change. That's the stuff that's under the couch. But we have seen, over the course of the run of This Week in Enterprise Tech, an industry actually affected by the pocketbook. We saw that after the Target breach, with credit card companies finally taking the pain, taking the hit to install at least something that was moderately better in the form of chip, not quite chip and PIN, but chip and sign credit cards. Lou, let me get you in on this, because one of the other issues here is the fact that the laws that are on the books in most states, and by the way, it does vary from state to state, there's no federal restrictions on this, they don't really account for the fact that we're not back in the 1960s. Back in the 60s, when a lot of these rules were created, a company might lose a ledger that had like the customers who came into that store, maybe their home address, maybe a phone number, but that was about it. And so that fine was fine for that amount of data. But today, in the digital age, a breach isn't just customers that come into a store. It could be everyone who's ever touched the network of a company ever. How is it that we haven't updated these laws yet?
I have no idea. That's a good question. I think there's all these new technologies. There's all these different currencies coming out. There's different ways to pay for things now. There's people leaking information left and right. There's credit card bureaus leaking information about our personal things. I mean, I don't get it. I don't know why. I mean, this particular case in general, the judge was like, well, from now on, you're going to hold companies accountable and make sure that they let people know when there is a breach in the most expedient time as possible. But it was really kind of open to interpretation, and that doesn't lead to any way of developing additional laws or even guidelines around these things to force more fees. So I think it's going to happen from the consumer space. Like the chat room is saying, we need to push these companies. We need to boycott these companies by paying cash. We're not sending a message. We're making it easier for them. They don't have to pay fees and all that stuff. And, we're not pushing them to do the right thing. And so companies, these companies like the credit card company that the bureau that had the issue, where people stopped using them and they're losing money and they're not being trusted anymore. And they're just kind of being forced to change. And I think that's the only way we're going to force legislation on these types of things.
Right. It's interesting here because, again, the language that you use, that's a language that we always hear in these cases. We are finally holding these companies accountable. And I get it. I don't think it's disingenuous. I think the attorney general's offices, they do what they can with the laws that are in front of them. $700,000, according to the law that is currently on the books in New York, that is actually a record. That is a landmark. This could have been one of these $20,000 slap on the wrists. Instead, it ends up being a $700,000 slap on the wrist. But, and Chibert, Lou, stop me if I'm wrong here, but in no way, shape, or form is that going to hold any of these corporations accountable. $700,000 is a fraction of their legal costs. So, it's not even a bump in the road, right?
It's dropping a bucket. Their insurance will pay for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So where is the accountability? And people have been screaming, well, maybe we need laws to have criminal penalties for this. And that gets iffy too, because then it becomes, well, who exactly goes down? And do you now just have a new fall guy? Maybe we can take inspiration from a law that's about to take effect in Europe. Now, you may not have heard of this, but the EU may have a solution that we want to copy in their new General Data Protection Rule, or GDPR. Now, that rule will go into effect in May of 2018. Now, instead of an amount that was set back in the days where a few hundred thousand dollars might be an incredible fine, the GDPR allows for fines to be based on a percentage of the annual turnover in the year before the breach. Now, what does that mean practically? Imagine this. Hilton was fined $700,000 for their gaffe, which was about 0.000006% of their breach year revenue. Under the new GDPR fine schedule, they could be fined 4% of $10.5 billion. That's $420 million. Now, T-Bert, I don't know about you, but $420 million doesn't seem to be quite the slap on the wrist that $700,000 is. Do you think that's enough to be noticed?
I think it's enough that Hilton will finally notice. $420 million doesn't sound like a lot when you compare it as 4%. But 4% is enough to get people fired in major corporations.
Right.
So hopefully something will happen. And the cool thing is if you do business in Europe, anything that touches the European Union has to comply with GDPR, which would be awesome.
Right. We've got JJ the 484 in the chat room saying, but should we be socialistic with fines? This is not socialism at all. This is a straight up fine. This is something that will actually hurt in the pocketbook. Because imagine, this is what we wanted as IT professionals. This is what we want to present before the corporation, before the enterprise. Right now, the perfect strategy for any breach is let the breach happen and pay a fine that's going to cost us nothing. Why would we invest in security if the alternative is something that's not going to affect us financially in any way or shape or form? This actually adds an incentive for you to spend money on security. If I know that I could be fined 4% of my annual revenue, that $420 million, if I know that it's going to cost me more than just a little bit of pocket change, then suddenly investing $100 million in security, in good security, in people who know what they're doing, seems like a bargain. That's where I think we want to go. And I think that's where the GDPR can really help. Now, the GDPR will only work in Europe. So for the international conglomerations, it would only affect the parts of the company that are actually in Europe. However, I would love to see something like this at least make its way through Congress. Maybe it won't pass the first couple of times. Maybe it will get lip service, but at least we could have that discussion. Because instead of $2 per record or less than a penny per day per person who is exposed, they'd be paying about $1,200 per record. And I think that's more in line with what my data is actually worth. Lou, let me throw this to you. This is a finem to learnem type law. This is, okay, you're not doing what you should do. You're not doing what your best practices tell you to do. So I'm going to give you incentive to actually do what you should be doing. Do you see a better alternative?
You know, I don't think so. I think that this is a big thing. I mean, this is forcing especially international companies to do the right thing, you know, especially over time. And the bigger the company, the harder they fall in this particular aspect. So they're forcing them to change all of their ways, you know, whether it's data storage or security. And it's forcing them to follow a bunch of practices and I think in guidelines. And I think, you know, they're held accountable for these things. And, you know, most companies, especially large ones, are global. And I don't see why these particular practices couldn't be applied back here in the United States with limited amount of cost to the company. So if this was made to law or of some kind of law here in the United States that's very similar, it would have companies incur less charge. Now, companies who only operate in the United States who don't kind of expand to the EU, they would have to incur this cost of doing better security and following these rules and guidelines. But again, I don't think that there's a better way to do this other than a forcing function to do the right thing.
Right, right. Chibert, I want to get you in on a nuance of this. Both of us were at Black Hat when Gear spoke, and he said something that really resonated with both of us, and that was 100% mm-hmm. transparent failure. We love this idea. Could that be the carrot to the stick? So if this fine is the stick, this is, if you don't do it, you're going to get hurt. Is the carrot, if you're 100% transparent with your failure, if you allow the community to actually help you, then you basically indemnify yourself from fines.
I think that'd be great. In fact, I like Emily the Strange's comment. You know, you should be forced to reveal the breaches. I like that. But yeah, you know, if you're a good boy, you tell people about it so that other people can actually do something about it. Yeah, I like, you know, okay, fine. I'm fine with them being indemnified unless there's, you know, maybe there's gross negligence.
Right.
Yeah. Like Yahoo.
Yeah. Yeah. No, actually, we've got that. That's a perfect example. Not only was it gross negligence and gross incompetence, but it was gross negligence and incompetence over years. This is not months, weeks. This was years. This was literally years where they kind of sat on the information thinking, well, maybe it will get better. And it never did. But okay, let's back up a little bit because it's easy to get fine happy. And I know what the criticism of this will be, which is, look, you can't fine innovation. But as has been mentioned several times in our chat room, is this finally the little bit that the IT person can go to the CTO or CFO and say, look, you know why you should spend on these systems? Because it's insurance. In the long run, spending $100, $200, $300 million now to stop billions of dollars of fines down the road year after year after year is a great investment. Ultimately, that's really the only language they're going to hear, right? I mean, if you're a C-suite executive, it's money. Oh, you're saving me money? Okay, I'll sign off on that.
Yeah, and that's what it took for HIPAA. And yeah. Then also what it took for Sarbanes-Oxley. So I guess we're going to have to do the same thing for breaches.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, and this is more looking into the future. What I like about this is this could create sort of a renaissance in the security industry. Because right now, as much as we love listening to people talk about security, it isn't – Chibert, check me on this. It's kind of an add-on industry, right?
Yeah. It's always been an afterthought. And, you know, we need investment in the industry. We need young folks like JJ coming through Augusta. And by the way, Augusta, congratulations for your master's program. Great step in the right direction. We need the investment, and we're not going to get it unless there's incentives. So maybe it starts becoming a whole suite. You know, we have sticks and carrots, but let's also go put some carrots on investing in the training of security experts. You know, maybe security education classes, you know, the certificates and things like that, make those deductible for the corporation so that we have some carrots to educate their people.
Right. We got PS Chops in the chat room, and he's referring to the fact that a lot of enterprises view IT as an afterthought, a necessary evil, a sort of a cost sink rather than a profit center. If you could show that your department is now saving hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, you actually could make a case for it being part of the profit center. So I'm gonna leave it at that. I'm sure we're gonna come back to this because the GDPR isn't law yet. It's gonna take effect in May of 2018, and we have plenty of time to actually look at it in action, see if it works. The first couple of tests, the first couple of big fines are really going to sort of stress whether or not this is a good idea or if this is just fines gone wrong. So stay tabbed. Now, when we come back, it's my favorite time of the show. It's when we bring a guest on who can drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a break to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you like the last time you went in for a mortgage? Of course you did. I mean, what's not to like? Bringing boxes of receipts and old pay stubs, talking to a complete rando about whether or not you're worthy to receive a loan, looking at your cash flow and trying to figure out which option is perfect for you. I mean, that's fun, right? That's fun. Oh, wait. No, that's the opposite of fun. That's horrifying. That's terrible. And worse than that, it just doesn't keep up with what we've come to expect in the digital age. Today, everything is connected. Everything is easier. Everything should be simple. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Now, this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. Allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient because their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. Now, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualified and then find the one that's just right for you. No more cookie-cutter mortgages. No more trying to force your way into a plan that might not be quite right. Rocket Mortgage will match you with exactly the mortgage that you want and exactly the options that you need. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully. Mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's welcome to the show a previous visitor to This Week in Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian McHenry. He is the Senior Manager of Customer Solutions at F5 Networks. Brian, thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you for the warm welcome.
Yeah. Oh, Brian, for the folks who maybe didn't catch your last appearance, exactly what is F5? Although that's kind of, yeah, that's a big company. And what is it that you do?
So at F5, we are the glue that holds networks and applications together. So what I mean by that is, we provide layer 4 to 7 solutions in an appliance form factor, whether physical or virtual, and really create traffic management, steering, inspection, all things above the network layer where your traditional firewalls and other solutions aren't necessarily going to be able to provide much visibility or control. Me personally, I'm actually just transitioning into a new role at F5 as a manager of our customer solutions engineering team. And in that role, I'm going to be responsible for building out things that are validated by F5 for our customers to simply take off the shelf as a deployment guide with templates for guided configurations and other pieces and parts that maybe aren't all F5 products, but making it easier to make F5 products work with everything else that's in your data center and in your application infrastructure.
Now, Chibert and I have a long history with F5 because F5 was long involved with the InteropNet. And I remember the glowing red ball in the data, the racks that we would bring to the show, those were always F5. And back in the day, you know, F5 was mainly known for making the world's best load balancers and application balancers. Yeah. That's what you did. That was your expertise. But then you spread out. Over the last 20 years, F5 has really sort of gotten their fingers into everything that might be top of rack. Why is that? Let's before we dive into things like single sign-on, why is it that you think that F5 has sort of slowly spidered its way into security and application performance?
That's a really good point. And for folks that aren't, you know, familiar with our technology, what they may not know is that if you've traded a stock online, accessed your bank account, booked an airfare, you name it, you know, checked a sports score, you've probably traversed F5 gear. We're pretty ubiquitous. And the reason for that is as folks started to push out these bigger and bigger web applications, needed a load balancer to scale it out, they found out what they really needed in addition to load balancing was intelligent traffic management. And F5 was pretty much the only game in town for a little while there in terms of being able to provide that layer 7 or application layer visibility. I can see what's going on in the application and make decisions based on that rather than simply IP address or, you know, source and destination or port. So how that's evolved is, hey, if I can see layer 7, I have this visibility, well, then I also have the opportunity to assert control, not just for traffic management and scale, but also things like authentication and access management, which we'll talk about in a bit. Also, web application firewall. The beauty of how the internet's evolved from an F5 perspective is that now everything is over HTTP and HTTPS, more precisely. And SSL and HTTP are the things that F5 really does best from a protocol perspective. So if you have this really powerful protocol parsing and ability to terminate SSL traffic and parse HTTP traffic at very high scale, including the scale of large distributed denial of service attacks, then you've got a pretty compelling all-in-one solution to do a number of really important things right at the edge of the data center facing the internet.
That actually is a very important point, that the whole idea of being at the edge of the data center, the edge of the internet, where the network touches the public network. Because a while back, I remember sitting through an F5 presentation, and they were talking about how they were going to get into authentication. Specifically, they wanted to provide some single sign-on solutions. Mm-hmm. And for a while there, I was thinking, okay, wait, so why is F5 getting into SSO? And then it made sense. It's like, wait a minute. If that's what's touching the public network, and if that's what has visibility into all my traffic, and that's what manages performance, then that's the natural place to have your authentication, right? You don't want your authentication buried layers in. You want it right there at the edge so that once you have that single sign-on, that single credential, you have access to everything you're supposed to have access to.
Yeah, that's absolutely what brought it about. You know, customers were, you know, and F5 is such a customer-driven company. We provide a lot of capability on the platform for you to customize and extend built-in capabilities, and that often informs what we're going to build next and bake into the product. Our customers are super inventive. We've opened up a GitHub channel as well, so we maintain our own GitHub repo, and that's, you know, anything that's on there is actually F5 supported solutions. So we continue to be this very customer driven company. And our customers are saying, hey, you've got this visibility at layer 7. You can see what's in the HTTP traffic. Can you do something with the authentication? Can you intercept the login credentials and maybe interact with my identity provider as well, right? So whatever that identity provider is, it could be a number of different directories, Active Directory probably being the most common, but certainly lots of opportunity there to, you know, intercept those credentials, validate that this user, and you guys were talking about breaches earlier. One of the things that is really taken off with a lot of the large banks and some of the more forward-thinking security organizations out there is really getting stronger authentication in their internet-facing web applications, where we may have had, you know, sort of weaker forms-based authentication before. Now multi-factor is becoming a much more ubiquitous service, and that's really great for consumers everywhere.
Right. Single factor, multi-factor, it's all ways to authenticate. But I want us to talk about a specific type, genre of authentication, and that's single sign-on. This has been the holy grail for quite a while. This idea of being able to build a system that would be able to verify a user once and then be able to pass him or her to all the services that that user should have access to. Let's start with some of the basics. Why is that so difficult? It seems very simple to explain. It's almost impossible to implement. Why?
Well, before recently, we didn't have a lot of uniform capability to assert authentication for different applications, right? So I'm going to sign into a SharePoint portal over here and then an SAP app and then some custom homegrown web app over there. All these different applications have different authentication mechanisms. One might be using Kerberos, another may be using forms-based, yet another NTLM. And so we have this sprawl of authentication methods that don't really play nice together. And if we rewind 5, 6, 7 years ago when F5 really started to adapt our remote access technology, our SSL VPN technology, onto our big IP platform, we saw an opportunity to do some single sign-on where we did a lot of translation and brokering of those different authentication types. Fast forward to now, and things are getting a lot easier if you have the right pieces in place to bridge it in, because we've got more standardized authentication protocols like SAML, OAuth, OpenID Connect. If you've ever signed into a web application on the internet today and they said, oh, just sign in with your Facebook or sign in with your Google login, that's actually SAML or OpenID Connect in the background handling basically the sharing of tokens, that website reaching out to Google and saying, hey, does this person have a token from you? Select that and prove that this person is who they say they are. Verify for me. So, but it takes some preparation to make that work, and that's why it's not quite as widespread as we'd all like it to be.
Let's talk about that preparation. Let's talk about those pieces that are required before you could actually even think about implementing any sort of single sign-on system.
Yeah.
So, of course, because F5's right at that boundary, because they've got 100% transparent, 100% what do you call it?
Visibility.
Visibility into the traffic. It's the perfect place to put my SSO. But what has to exist on the back end? So if I'm designing a system right now, I'm in charge of that 10,000-seat enterprise network, what do I have to have in place before I can turn the key?
So you want to make sure that – and we conflate this practice into identity and access management, or IAM, and you'll see that mentioned in a lot of places. However, it's important not to conflate it when you're going to architect your solution. What you want to do is look at the two pieces discreetly, right? F5, we're an access management solution. The other part is the identity piece. And so you have to look at your backend applications and say, what is their source of truth for identity? Is it Ping? Is it Okta? Is it Active Directory? Is it some combination of all these things? So you really need to kind of survey your backend application infrastructure and say, what are the authentication types that are accepted today? And what are my options going forward? Like, how do I tie them into that single source of identity truth, if you will?
Okay. So I've seen SSO solutions from a couple of different companies. Cisco had one that they demoed for me. HP had one that they demoed. Even Google, Microsoft, Amazon have SSO services. I wouldn't even really call them complete solutions yet. But how does the F5 SSO work? What's your special sauce? What do you think you do better than any of your competitors?
Well, I'll go out in a little bit of a limb here and say that we don't really have a lot of natural competition in this space. What we do better is get in line with the web traffic. Typically, again, we're talking about web applications, talking about HTTP. This is something we do very well. Many cases, because of our ubiquity, we already have that footprint. And you simply need to, if you're already doing application delivery or maybe application firewall and load balancing with F5, it's simply licensing an additional capability on your platform. And then some configuration steps, of course. But so that's where we're different. So all of these full-blown IAM, identity and access management solutions, like your Pings, your Octas, you know, you mentioned a few, Microsoft and Amazon offers things. They're all good at providing maybe the identity store.
Right.
They're not necessarily as good as getting in line with the traffic. So where F5 really fits in is let's take whatever your identity store of choice is and help them get in line with your traffic so that it's a much more seamless experience for your users.
Right. Rather than dumping a bunch of traffic onto an authentication service that might live in my network or in the cloud, right. What if the gateway for the traffic was the SSO?
Right.
That's a good strategy. Okay, and I think our listeners and our viewers, they understand the value here. They get it. If I have a system that can follow a user through the system, it can have a single point of authentication, that makes much more sense. It's easier to manage. Yeah. It's easier to revoke or grant privileges. All those things, that's the dream. That's the holy grail. However, we got to be honest with our audience and discuss some of the dangers because there are some drawbacks to having an SSO, especially if you implement it incorrectly. What for you? What's the dark side? If all the management is the holy grail, what is the thing that you say if you're going to implement SSO, you need to make sure you've accounted for this?
So, one, you got to make sure your directory infrastructure is really resilient. One of the bad things about having an account, you know, I've got an account in Office 365, an account in Salesforce. I got an account over here in ServiceNow or whatever the other, that's the other thing that's going on here, right? We have a lot of these SaaS services that we're provisioning to our internal employees in the enterprise, and they've got logins everywhere, and they've got different passwords to remember, and I've got to spin them up, spin them down as needed, right? Onboarding and offboarding of employees. So that's very tedious and cumbersome. Single sign-on solves that. But if my directory, my Active Directory is holding everything, so I'm just going to use Active Directory as the example, as the directory store here. If that Active Directory goes down or if it gets improperly configured, then I could potentially take out all of my employees' access to everything. Similarly, if you've not, properly broken up your user groups and created different ways to authorize your individual users, then you could have somebody ends up with access that they shouldn't have. So that can be a definite problem. So a lot of your ability to properly apply authorization levels with a single sign-on solution comes down to did I structure my directory sensibly? Did I create the right attributes and criteria in order to apply policy, right? So a simple list of users is not enough information in the directory to give the access management solution information on what to do when a certain user accesses it. So it's really important to structure your directory stores properly. Another thing is a lot of SSO solutions will ask you, and Azure is guilty of this, Okta, a lot of your so-called CASB or cloud and access cloud access security brokers, a lot of your CASB solutions will ask you to clone your directory or sync your directory infrastructure into their cloud. That's something that it can be risky, right? I trust Microsoft, I trust Okta, I trust my providers, but this is all of my employees' PII data now being cloned into an environment I don't have explicit control over. So that's another risk to look out for, and that's something that not coincidentally F5 can help you manage that, right? By creating that access point at the edge of your network and tying it to your identity provider, whatever it may be, whatever that directory infrastructure is, we can help you not have to clone that directory into a cloud. And you're compliant. It may not be simple risk, right? Might not even be about trust. It might be about regulatory compliance. Says, hey, your employee's PII data has to be in your explicit control. We don't care whether you trust your business partner for SSO 100,000%. We don't care, right? So, you know, things like GDPR, for example, have some very explicit rules about where data can live physically. And so you have to be mindful of that.
Oh, we've got PS Chops in the chat room, and he's saying that, you know, he worked at a 250,000-plus employee company, and trying to maintain the central repository of user data was, well, yeah, it was daunting. It was absolutely daunting. And in a situation like that, some IT managers who I know, they actually kind of prefer things to be segmented. It's easier for them because they've got smaller chunks that they have to worry about, and they don't have to worry about making, as you said, one massive problem, one massive error that affects the entire directory tree. How would you respond to that? Someone who comes to you and says, look, so what if my users have to remember four different usernames and passwords? It means that my job is easier. It means its delegation is easier, and it means that maintenance is simpler.
Yeah, so there are strategies, and I'm not an identity store expert by any stretch of the imagination, but my prior life before F5, I did have to manage, you know, fairly large exchange infrastructures, deal with Active Directory in some of its nascent phases. And I'll say that there's a lot of there's art and science to building Active Directory domains and forests and trusts that can help alleviate a lot of those problems. And if you go to other directory services, whether you want to go open source and go LDAP, or you want to use something, you want to use Radius or one of these other services, they're there too, but they all have facility for maybe breaking the directory stores up into smaller pieces, but creating interdomain trusts that does distribute your risk domain, your failure domain, as well as make management and the delegation of tasks a little bit more tenable. But these are the kinds of things that tend to grow organically over time, and it's entirely possible that a 250,000 person company at some point realized, without realizing it, ended up with one very large directory or domain without a lot of logical breaks in business units and what have you to create something that's more manageable. So these things can grow organically right under your feet. And next thing you know, you have this bear, this monolith that cannot be wrestled to the ground without maybe, you know, taking it out, shooting it, and starting over.
I worked with a group not too long ago, and they described their data store as it was the Winchester Mystery House. In case you've never heard of it, it's here in San Jose in the Bay Area, and they kind of went crazy. Winchester rifles, and the widow just kept building rooms, and they didn't make sense, and their staircases going to nowhere, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Said it's kind of like that. You know, you don't notice it the first 20 years, but then by the time you get to year 21 and you look back at what you got and you've realized – I can't fix this, not without blowing it up. And I think in the chat room, we got PS Chops who's talking about this again. I think that's what it is. It's not necessarily that this is more difficult. It's just that it's very different from anything that has, as you mentioned, grown organically. And that's always scary. Let me bring my co-host back in here because I see them chomping at the bit in the preview monitor over here. Lou, you've got a little experience with authentication. It's sort of part, one of your ballywicks. It's part of your product. Tell me, what do you think about F5's approach to SSO, and what questions do you get?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's interesting because, you know, like a lot of organizations today, they do have these third-party applications. They have, you know, they have CRM systems, they have sales systems, they have, you know, email systems, and they're all might be third-party, some of them on-prem, some of them in the cloud. And so, like discussions happen, you know, sometimes you need to be able to provide the single sign-on capability. And sometimes you don't want to have to dir sync everything from one directory to the next. And so providing single sign-on capabilities is, you know, a top-notch requirement sometimes to ease people's pain. And federation of these things is the number one component of that. And so, you know, I think, you know, F5 is providing a service that kind of eases the pain to kind of get to where you need to go. And there's a lot of options out there today when it talks about identity federation. You know, there's, you know, Amazon offers the IAM identity provider services, IDP, Azure offers AAD Federation services, and they offer these capabilities to allow you to not only federate between all these, having an identity or some kind of unique identifier that allows users to go from one system to the next, but it also allows them to kind of ease the pain of having to sync everything everywhere. So I think one question I had is, what does it take to get somebody started when you're kind of integrating the two different systems together? Do you need to just, register applications in the system, or what's kind of the startup cost to kind of get things two things integrated together?
It's fairly straightforward. So especially, again, if you have the advantage of F5 already being in the path of the application in question, then you've got a fairly good opportunity, right? And there's two different scenarios here as well, I should mention, right? There's the scenario where you have something internet facing, it's an application you own, it's inside your data center or inside, and then when I say your data center, it could be your cloud data center, your physical data center, what have you, but it's something you own, it's an application you own. You terminate that SSL traffic inbound, probably on a piece of F5 gear, and you're going to make a load balancing decision of some sort. That's at that point where we have a visual policy editor. It's fairly easy at that point to intercept the forms-based or other types of authentication methods, and then forward that over sort of sideband to the directory service, whatever it happens to be, and generate a token at that point. Generate a SAML token is the most common use case on the F5 platform, but we can certainly do it in some other ways with cookies and other things if SAML is not tenable. And so that's one way. The other thing that we're talking about is a lot of these SaaS services out in the cloud, particularly Office 365 is a big use case for F5's customers. For a long time, we've been the application delivery solution and provided single sign-on, say, between Exchange and SharePoint on-prem. Now these things are moving off to Office 365, and customers are looking for similar solutions, but more for this outbound traffic flow to something they don't necessarily own. And for those customers, we're actually launching with our upcoming version of firmware, which will be version 13.1 of BIG-IP, and that'll be out next month. We actually had a big props from Microsoft at Ignite, where they debuted our solution on stage, where we were one of the first, if not the only, and maybe Lou can correct me there, solutions as certified by Microsoft for proxying the ADFS PIP protocol traffic. So enabling us to be that bridge point of the ADFS traffic from your data center into Azure or Office 365.
So let's go look in a crystal ball. We all kind of agree that SSO is coming. Multi-factor authentication is coming. But there seems to be a lot of roadblocks. But we also agree that we want federation. Mm-hmm. Do we think we're going to start seeing a all-encompassing identity store that does the federation? Or are we going to see it at the edge, like in the F5 solution? Or are we going to see something in between? Or are we going to see some intermediary steps? How's your crystal ball on this?
I think it's going to come down to organization by organization basis, right? Some organizations, we're going to have the people who are comfortable with architecting these solutions, and they're going to say, I want the control. I'm comfortable with asserting that control and being responsible for it. And then you're going to have smaller organizations that just need stuff to work, and they're not going to be very excited about the prospect of managing the directory store. They're going to be happy letting a third-party provider, whether it's Amazon or Microsoft or Ping or Okta, to do that for them in the cloud. So I think you're going to see a lot of different things. But as you see, younger companies grow up, they're going to grow up with the notion of that this stuff, that it's federation is sort of a de facto thing to expect. And then you're going to see older companies, and PS Chops was in the chat room talking about sort of getting all the buy-in from the different business units of how you do this. The other part of that is if you're talking about stuff that you don't own that's different outside the organization, go to your SaaS provider. Do they support the authentication types that I want to support? Does Salesforce support it? Does Office 365 support the same thing? Or am I going to have to use a different auth type and do some sort of protocol bridging or authentication translation to handle this situation? So, you definitely have to survey. And I think, if I'm a manager of these services today, I'm looking at, all right, one line of business is wanting to use some SaaS service. I'm going to look at what do they support the, you know, my strategy, overall strategy for Federation. And can I assert, and we haven't really, we've only mentioned it briefly a couple times, but another thing that you really want to look at is what is my facility for multi-factor with all these solutions, right? I want to be able to, on a per application or per SaaS service basis, be able to say, hey, this is a more sensitive service. I want to assert, a YubiKey. I want to assert that you need a one-time password via text or, and that's fallen by the wayside, or maybe it's an app, Google Authenticator on your phone. So there's all these different ways to get MFA, and some are stronger than others. And we're going to want to look at the sensitivity of the data that's being presented by the application and say, all right, well, based on the sensitivity, I'm going to search stronger MFA if any at all. But that's also – the MFA has got to tie into my identity and, really looking at, we're long past the days where an IAM provider, a solution provider, can say, oh, I only support my own proprietary protocol. No, they've got to support, SAML, OAuth, OpenID Connect, JWT tokens are becoming the new thing. So there's a number of different layers of technology going on here and authentication standards. And you really, it's one of the components you should be evaluating any new application, whether you're building it in-house, bringing in off-the-shelf software, or actually going out to some SaaS service and saying, hey, we want to offload some of our IT function into a SaaS-based solution. Got to make sure the authentication support is there.
So one interesting thing is, there has been an influx of corporations implementing or using third party identity services. And you kind of pointed that out, and a lot of services today are kind of required to kind of allow, if you're going to have an application, you need to be able to support these third party services. And so one thing that is also good to point out is, Azure AD does have a federation capability, and it does have the ability. Now, there's a company called Oxford Computer Group that did kind of a third party testing of all different ways of single sign-on using non-Microsoft identity providers. And so this is just not necessarily a comprehensive list, but you could just kind of see the amount of identity providers out there today that are required for a lot of these kind of big, large corporations / large application SaaS and lab applications that are out there today that require integration not only to Microsoft but to themselves. And so, things like Azure AD, they provide this capability of kind of doing third-party integration. And I think it's kind of easing the pain for customers across the board and corporations, enterprises across the board, so that they allow them to not have to incur this cost of having to do it themselves. Like you said, it's, they tested things like two-factor authentication, single sign-on scenarios, alternate IDs, which is actually big because a lot of times UPNs or user principal names don't always match that particular user's name. Kind of easing that pain as well. And I think these are kind of, I would say, would you think to say that these are kind of like guidelines for any type of single sign-on capability today, is to make sure they have this type of services kind of going across the board?
Yeah, I would agree 100%. We see all the time someone's brought in an application and they find out after the fact that, you can't use the same directory store. So now we're doing things like, you said the UPN. That's something that F5, I've encountered personally a number of customers where we're architecting a solution that says, all right, let's, we actually create a credential mapping list to say, this username and this format, we use, some regex do those transformations so that we can, when they come in with your one username, we can map it to the expected format on the new directory store to help with the transition from maybe some legacy system into a newer authentication type. Running down those compatibility lists, finding a directory store like Azure AD that's really flexible and has those kinds of lists of IAM providers that they integrate with is super powerful in terms of arming you with the information you need to make a good decision for your organization. I wish there was a really easy best practice advice I could give to all the listeners out there is say, oh, go pick this solution and definitely use F5. I mean, I'd love for you to use F5, but F5 might not be the best thing in your environment. Although we are super flexible and one of the, you know, I always say that, you know, there's a lot of Microsoft shops out in the world. There's a lot of Cisco shops, VMware shops. Nobody calls themselves an F5 shop, even though they probably all have F5 somewhere. And that's because we're the glue that ties a lot of things together. And, you know, being able to work with third-party things is something that we've done for a long time. And as recently in the world of cloud and SDN has become much more fashionable. You've got to, you know, I'm amazed to see companies like CA SiteMinder who have, you know, with their SiteMinder product has long been very, very proprietary in terms of their authentication protocol. And then now they, you know, in recent years have embraced SAML and OAuth and some other newer authentication protocols, you know, really see, you know, seeing for the first time that, you know, auth is not something you can kind of keep in a silo any longer.
You know, Brian, I don't think being described as the glue that holds all the solutions together is a bad thing. And again, T-Bird and I have been working with F5 for a long, long time. And you do just sort of inherently provide a little bit of confidence in the solution. Listen, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on This Week in Enterprise Tech. This has been fascinating. I like doing deeper dives than we can normally get to. And single sign-on is one of these things that's not going to go away. And hopefully we're going to see more and more alternatives, more and more solutions. As you said, more and more companies that are willing to actually create turnkey solutions. Now, if people wanted to find out more about F5, more about single sign-on, more about what you do, and yes, I understand that this is a little complicated. There's a lot of different pieces they need. But where can they go? Maybe not to get best practices, but at least to get a start into something that can be very daunting.
First, I want to thank you for inviting me back. Please feel free to invite me anytime. This is always fun. I've enjoyed it both times, and I'd love to be a regular if you'll have me. The F5.com is your best source of information. And if you go to F5.com/security, it'll drop you into a lot of these types of solutions. And you can see there security and you'll be able to scroll down. Here's application security, for example, that we're showing on the screen here. Also, don't give any short shrift to our Dev Central user community. You don't have to believe me. I've worked for F5 for 10 years because I was an F5 customer before and found that F5 made me look a lot smarter than I am. But over on Dev Central, we have over 250,000 registered active users in our user community. And as I said before, we're a very customer-driven company. There are, you know, forums for, you know, discussing any challenges that you may have. There are ways to connect with other users as well as, you know, F5ers like myself. I write articles from there on there from time to time. We have these great lightboard lessons that my friend John Wagnon and Pete Silva frequently run these lightboard lessons. And if you haven't seen one before, they basically stand behind this whiteboard that's a piece of glass, and you can see a clip there. Really cool thing. It's on my bucket list of things to do at F5. I want to, you know, basically, you know, get behind that thing, and there's a lot of neat camera tricks that they do to make this possible. Really help you digest these solutions in great detail in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. So there's a lot of good information over there, but also a lot of good, you know, frank, honest user feedback is where we share a lot of solutions. And you can really, you know, get tapped into, you know, what is the latest thing, not just what's on our website. And if you want to follow me, I'm at B.A. McHenry. My middle name is Alexander. And so that's a coincidental thing. My initials are BAM. So feel free to follow me on Twitter. It is mostly work related. You know, occasionally you see me gripe about travel or talk about my kids' lacrosse games. You know, random pictures of tactical baby carriers.
Oh, yeah, that's different.
But mostly InfoSec related. I do share on there. That's where you'll find me post up the links to my monthly column on Information Security Buzz. I have an article up now about DDoS and another, you know, you, linking over to one of my favorite recent ones that I think I had pinned to my profile for the new OWASP top 10. But I'm actually working on a piece right now about identity and access management, and I'll definitely provide some links in that article about some of the things we talked about today.
Brian, thank you so very, very much. And I guess the only thing that's left is to tell our audience to follow the BAM. You are definitely invited whenever you want to come back on. Gbert will be the man to contact. And we appreciate you dropping all this knowledge on the Twilight Riot.
This is a great group, and I always have fun.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 single sign-on solutions. I thanked our guests, but I also want to thank my co-hosts, without whom I would not want to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's start with you, Lou. It's nice that you're home, even though it's kind of strange that you've got a snow day already. What's up with you? Where can people find your work? And where should people go to see more about the great Lou MM?
Absolutely. Well, you can always find my work at dev.office.com, and also check out the fact that, we just kind of implemented the single sign-on capabilities for your Office extensions as well as your add-ins extensions. We offer single sign-on for you as a developer on top of Office, and how you can kind of offer single sign-on across your applications and your extensions that you're building in the add-ins. And you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. Just check me out of all my work, and of course, some personal projects as well that I debuted there.
Lou, thanks again. We'll see you. Are you on next week, or I forget? Are you off?
I am. Yes, just the week right before Thanksgiving.
I won't be. Got it. Okay. Also, we need to give big thanks and big props to Mr. Brian Chi, again, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, aside from throwing sensors into the Alawai, which runs right behind my old house, what are you up to?
Actually, right after the show, I'm going to have a fast lunch, and I'm going to escape the traffic Trumpocalypse.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He's over there today, isn't he?
Yeah. We're expecting that Honolulu is going to turn into a giant parking lot about 1:30 this afternoon.
Well, considering the fact that there's basically one highway that goes around the island, there's no way to avoid it, right?
Yeah, and the worst part is he's zigzagging across the island several times.
No.
And yes, JJ, there are going to be some epic protests going on, which are going to do wonders for the traffic.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that he wanted to visit Kenya.
Yeah.
Okay. No, we're not getting to that. Chibert, thank you very much. Chibert and Lou, again, my friends, thank you, thank you, thank you. And also, thank you to the person who comes back every week to watch and to listen. We wouldn't have a show without you, and we want to make it easier for you to get your dose of enterprise goodness. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. That's TWIET. There you'll find all of our back episodes along with show notes. They'll contain links to all the stories that we've covered on the show, as well as contact information for our guests. Again, that's twit.tv/twiet. As long as you're there, why not subscribe? It's the best way to support the show. If you want to keep seeing Twiet, if you want to share it with your friends, drop down a little menu and get the version of choice, either audio, video, or high-definition video, into your device of choice. Again, once more, that's twit.tv/TWIET. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. Follow me there, and you'll see what I'm doing when I'm not in the studio. You'll see what's coming, like when I'm, for example, telling people that tarts are horrible and they should never have been created, and they're just terrible, terrible, terrible things. And I'm serious about that. I'm afraid of tarts. If you want to see all the desserts that I'm afraid of, you can follow me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible, to our engineers, Alex, Jammer B, and Burke, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing this show for almost 6 years now, and of course, to my fantastic TD, Kevin. Kevin the Shark Boy. Kevin, this is normally the time of the show where we ask you a little bit of trivia from the episode to see if you were actually paying attention when you were pushing all the buttons. This one's super, super simple. What does regex mean?
Rejected by red.
Oh, colors. That was so close. That's regular expression. But Kevin, you'll get another chance next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit. Just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, Just keep twiet.